Podcast, and I'm your host, Rillian. Hello, and welcome to part two of the Prince Caspian analysis. The Narnia Web Council got together and had a really great discussion, and we're going to go ahead and listen in on what we talked about this time. Well, we are back, the Narnia Web Council, discussing Prince Caspian, our second episode on the analysis. And with us today, we have Jim Fan. Jim Fan, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
And as usual, we have Glumpuddle. Glummy, how are you doing?
Good. Hello.
How many times have you seen the movie now?
I saw it for the fifth time last night.
There's the freak for you, everyone. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm pretty fresh.
And we're really excited to have Warrior for Jesus with us today. Warrior, good to have you with us.
G'day, everyone.
Warrior is joining us from Australia. And where are you in Australia again?
Adelaide in South Australia.
Okay. And the movie came out, what, last week for you guys?
The 5th of June, and I saw that night.
Okay. Well, we're really glad to have you here. It's a little tricky sometimes with the time difference, coordinating with people of different countries. And
absolutely.
I think 10:23 in the morning for Warrior right now. It's about 8 or 9 or 7 in the evening for us here in the U.S. So we're really glad that everyone can be here. And we're just going to pick right up where we left off. Glumpuddle, where are we right now?
We just finished on the last episode. I think we finished where Trumpkin is. He's in sort of on trial, I guess you could call it. He's just been captured. Mara is saying, Caspian was abducted by Nantes. And then we begin. We're going to begin this one where they find the treasure chamber.
Okay. And go ahead and give us a recap. It doesn't just start off in the treasure chamber. Can you just give us a quick rundown of the dialogue, kind of a summary?
Yeah, it starts, Edmund's looking at something, and he, says that, he finds catapults. It says, deduces that Caravelle was attacked. And then they go through that whole thing of Peter trying, being all smart and trying to make a torch, and it turns out Edmund just has a flashlight in his bag the whole time. Or an electric torch, I'm sorry. And then they find the treasure chamber, and they have the memorable moment where Peter pulls out his sword and says the inscription of "When a son bears his teeth, winter meets its death," and all that. Very much
blah,
like
blah,
in the
blah.
Book. Yeah.
All right, now, okay, so let's basically start off with the thoughts on the scene. Let's see, Jim Fan, ladies first. Why don't you tell us what you thought of the scene and its place in the movie and everything?
I really like this part. The whole, from when the Pevensies came from England, to when they pretty much met Trumpkin, I thought went really fast. But I really like this particular scene. I like the part with the torch. And I like the way they made the treasure chamber. I thought that was a really interesting way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, does anyone know if they still say electric torch in the UK?
No.
I wouldn't have a clue, sorry.
What do you call them down in Australia? You call them flashlights?
You call them torches.
Torches, yep. Okay.
Yeah, there you go. Follow the UK.
Torches, okay.
Torches.
It's my Aussie accent. sorry.
That's fine.
I can actually do a pretty good Scottish accent. I've been told by my friends who are Scottish. But anyway, not now. Not now. And Glumpuddle, what do you think?
I like that they worked in, they kind of made a joke out of the fact that Edmund had had a flashlight. In the book, I found it kind of unbelievable. They just so happened to have matches and pocket knives and all these things. And they kind of made it, and first off, it does make sense the way they did it in the movie, where he had his bag on him when he was brought to Narnia, and he just so happened to have a flashlight in there. And I like that they kind of made a joke out of it, like, why didn't you tell me you had a freaking flashlight in your bag? That would have been nice. And then when they enter the treasure chamber, I was kind of disappointed with how they designed the treasure chamber, just because there wasn't really much, for one thing, there wasn't really much treasure. And it wasn't as, like, when they have that, you know, the music kind of swells and everything, you know, I kind of wondered, well, what's so amazing, you know? And, you know, I think the scene ultimately, it does what it needs to do, but I was hoping for something a little more magnificent for the treasure chamber. And also, I didn't like that it was so obviously damaged from the attack on Cair Pareveld. There was a lot of signs of damage. I felt like in the book it was cool how everything else is damaged. Then they find this one sort of, you know,
almost
locked
an
up
armory.
Place. Yeah, it's completely untouched. And from in they can actually, something that they recognize. All of the rest of Cair Pareveld is completely unrecognizable, and this is something that they can actually, almost like a time machine, they can recognize. And I didn't think they captured that element of it in the movie, although I still think the scene does what it needs to do, which is kind of gives the Pevensies a chance to say, okay, we really are back. This really is Cair Pareveld, and sort of experience the joy of, well, we're finally back, we're finally back.
Yeah. Warrior, what were your thoughts on this scene?
I really liked the scene. It was quite different from the book in that it was lit differently. They didn't need the torch, really. It was so well lit.
Yeah,
that's true.
That's true.
It had a lot of detail. I liked the detail, the aged look. It was more roomy than I suspected it would be, but I thought it was really authentic in how it looked historical, like ages had passed in Narnia. And it was just one of those wow moments for me. Like, it was different from the book in a way, but I really enjoyed it still.
Yeah, I
agree with just want to say I agree with what you say about the lightning. And actually, I had always envisioned the moment in the book where Edmund shines his torch around, and they all go, oh, and they all see it. I'd always imagined that would be a great moment on film, and that wasn't in the movie.
Yeah, I had thought it would be a bit darker, but it was really light.
It's like one of those Indiana Jones sets. Where is the light coming from?
Yeah.
I mean, really.
I guess we can assume that, you know, there's daylight streaming in from somewhere, or I don't know. But
see, if there were windows, wouldn't someone found it?
I guess that's a good point. I don't know.
No, they didn't
that's
have
a good point, actually.
They didn't have helicopter flyovers back then.
There you go.
But, movie magic.
One thing, I was reading the book again, and I read it actually finished right after the movie, and it was interesting for me to, of course, go through this scene, because I think that actually the kind of the still, though I would have done this little bit to the scene different in terms of set design, maybe, I did think it kind of captured the essence of, in a sense, the, while they did have everything preserved, it's still the melancholy nature of, here's the, you know, dresses we wore to this ball. Here's the, you know, shield you won, you used at this tournament, you know. And I think they, without really using that dialogue, you know, we had the dialogue that was not in the book, was not actually verbalized in the book, where Lucy says, Mr. Tumnus and the beavers, they're all gone. And I think it does, I think it was, that was an appropriate moment to have in this scene especially, and I think they did, you know, show the joy of returning to Narnia early on, and then here's the element of, you know, I think it's time we found out what happened here, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, at the beginning, beginning of the scene, it's all joyful, we're back, and then it kind of, oh, wait a second, everyone's dead, you know, yeah, I thought that was...
That sucked.
Yeah. Oh, snap. Yeah, I think one of the most powerful kind of little moments, sort of unspoken moments in the film, was when Peter blows the dust away from that plate thing, and then just kind of looks up, and that just captures the essence of the book for me. It's like, wow,
that was very cool.
Back, yeah, I thought that was, and the music is great there, and I thought Willie Mosley did a really good job in the scene when he's walking up to, you know, open his chest and everything, and you feel like, you know, where. You know, they kind of feel like this is home. This is where I belong, you know?
This is where I belong. Finally.
You want to do a solo?
No, I don't really want to do a solo. I think we should all do it together.
No. Oh, there's probably a couple seconds delay, so I'm not sure if it would work
or
not.
Oh, that's probably true. But, you know, I think one of my most interesting moments, at least for how they developed the character of Peter, really starts to build in this scene at the part where he just walks up to the statue of himself and is looking at the statue. And I think, and I can kind of see the oddity of that. You can imagine going, you know, let's say you, you know, in this world, and let you say you became some great war hero or something, and you go to a time in the future where you're a, still a young person and you walk up to a statue of yourself as an adult. I think that kind of is where they really start to build on Peter's development in this film.
Yep. Yeah, that was a really weird moment when you saw that statue.
Sorry, Jim found you were going to say something.
That's what I look like.
I shouldn't have got the haircut.
Let's see, you know, what else, what comes right after this?
They rescue Chumpkin, which is a very, very quick transition.
Right. That is, that's right.
Yeah. I think
they
that
find all their clothes. They find all their stuff.
And the clothes are
I guess it's not that big of a stretch to say, well, they were probably clothes in the treasure chain. It would have been nice for.
But they wouldn't have had clothes from, you know, when they were, you know, when they were like 10 years old.
Well, you're right. Probably
they
not.
Wouldn't have fit them. They wouldn't have kept them around unless they were really special or had some, you know, memories attached to them. But
you're probably right. If you really analyze it, it says, well, most likely they wouldn't. But I'm just saying, they had to. They kind of had to get new clothes, I think, for
yeah.
the film.
Yeah, I can suspect.
It's not that big of a stretch to say, oh, they had clothes in the treasure chamber or somewhere. You know, I can just kind of go with that.
You two sound like Shasta and Erebus right now, bickering.
Oh, really?
You do.
I reckon Aslan protected them from the moths.
That's right. But I think this probably more than any other part of the film, I felt like it needed one little extra scene in between here to bridge the gap. Like, I think this is the moment. You know, a lot of people have talked about how the movie goes by so fast, and you know, I was, for the most part, pretty okay with the way it was paced. Except for right here, where it just kind of magically cuts into there. Yeah, just bang, and then they come out of nowhere. Yeah, and when they rescue Chumpkin, they needed one more little moment there.
Was that supposed to be the same day or the day after, do you know?
Same day,
I would imagine the same day, I suppose. Yeah, but it just, they just needed something more, I don't know. I'm not sure what they could have put, but they needed something more.
Warrior, did you have some thoughts here?
I was a bit confused in that section. I was like, I've read the book and I don't even know what's happening here. obviously it changed the format a lot from to the movie, but it needed something in there to show the transition that this is what it's leading up to this scene or something, because it was very quick change of pace. You're in the like treasure chambers and the Pevensies are getting all their armor and equipment and all that, and then like Trumpkin's getting rescued or something, just needed something extra in there.
Did anyone?
Yeah, I think maybe they wanted the Pevensies to, like, when they run up, they wanted it to kind of see it from the soldier's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe maybe what they needed to do though is cut back to Miraz or cut to Caspian or something, and then cut back to the soldiers taking Trumpkin to his death, so that the Pevensies can still come out of nowhere, and you have that surprise, but it's more believable. More time.
That would be better. Yeah.
I get the sense there's probably a deleted scene there.
Am I the only one? I mean, I'm wondering how many people noticed that the two Telmarines have British accents.
So
they kind of Polish to me.
You won't stop staring. I don't know. It sounds the Telmarines in general sounded a little bit all over the place. Espion's accent seemed very different from Ben Barnes' accent.
Yeah,
and Glazell's accent was quite a bit different from Sepespian's.
I agree.
I mean, I'm watching Sepespian and I'm thinking he looks like a character from The Mask of Zorro.
I didn't. Do you think they have British accents when they're in the boat?
I don't know. I've only seen it twice, but the second time it seemed like they were two characters out of Pirates of the Caribbean.
I didn't hear any British accents. So I don't know what you're on about.
Oh, well, maybe I was wrong. Maybe it was just my imagination, but it didn't sound at all like the Telmarine accents I'd heard so far in the film.
Yeah, it swapped from Polish to Spanish to some other Mediterranean thing.
Yeah.
I don't know what.
Yeah, well, yeah, I have to say, I don't know, what was the response in your guys' theaters when Trumpkin's just staring at the guy? Did everyone laugh? Because everyone just
I
loved
was in
that
a
moment.
Really great theater, so everyone had all the right responses, but yeah, they laughed.
Yeah, that was a little. In mine, it was just sort of a little bit of nervous laughter there, and it is a really weird stare. Peter Dinklage was so good at that. Maybe it's CG. I don't know. That was a pretty awesome stare.
Sort of, I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to enjoy it. You know?
I always get the feeling like he's trying to creep the soldier out, so he'll let him
I
go.
Know. It's
having his last bit of fun before he goes to his doom.
Right.
Well, I love it because it's just, at least for the how they do Trumpkin in this story, which is a little different from the book, but I still love it, is just sort of this, I'm going to, the Trumpkin is one tough character.
Yeah.
And very resilient, and which I guess you could also say he is in the book, but I just love that moment in the film. But what did you guys think of basically Trumpkin's rescue and interaction with the Pevensies? Wario, let's start with you this time.
Who's going to go first?
Sorry, Wario's going first.
Okay. I've seen it ages ago. So this is the scene with the night raid, sort of, isn't it? Leading up to the night.
No. This is the scene where, you know.
Oh, sorry. Susan shoots in the river.
Yeah. Susan shoots the soldier and Trumpkin.
Yes. I thought that scene was handled quite well. It seems pretty much straight out of the book. I guess I would have liked the mention of the Telmarines being afraid of ghosts in the forest or whatever. Mm-hmm. But other than that, there was a different element to it. I liked the boat the Telmarines were in and how Trumpkin was like the stairs. That was good. And then Susan, she wasn't so gentle. She, got one of the Telmarines, but then the other one jumped in. So that wasn't manslaughter too much manslaughter. I think that scene was handled quite well. I guess I expected Trumpkin to be not quite so grumpy towards them. Yeah. I can see why he would be, but it just seemed quite a transition. I'm not saying it's bad, it was just quite different from C.S. Lewis's vision.
It seems kind of consistent with the character, and obviously they kind of wanted it to be comical for him to be almost upset that he was rescued, but I don't really understand why. Like, what exactly was he mad at them for doing?
I just saved my life.
A simple thank you would suffice.
I don't get what he was. I mean, like, did he really wish they just kind of let him drown? I mean, I was confused.
I think
at that
just
part.
Had a bad day.
Yeah, I think they just wanted to do the unexpected and wanted kind of a funny moment and wanted there to be little tension when they rescue him, like when we first meet him. But that didn't really make sense to me.
They took out my favorite line, though.
What's your line?
In the book, they said, "Oh, why were they trying to drown you?" Whatever, and he says, "Oh, I'm a dangerous criminal, I am."
Yeah.
Or something like that. Oh, I wanted him that in there so bad, and they didn't put it in.
Yeah, because then at the time,
that
you don't.
It was too funny for him.
Although
he's
it probably.
Jokes.
Yeah, that probably wouldn't have had the same power it does in the book, because we pretty much know that Trumpkin's a good guy right here because
That's
of the way that they restructured it. In the book, he says he's a dangerous criminal, and you think, well, maybe he is a dangerous criminal. And you find out later that he's kind of being sarcastic, that, technically he is because he's, going against Miraz and he's part of that rebellion, but that's what you find out when you reread it. But the first time he says it, you wonder, is he a dangerous criminal? It kind of makes you all the more curious about him. So I'm not sure if that would have had the same power it does in the book.
Especially
I always thought he was
first...
just pulling their legs.
Yeah.
Well, in the first one, especially the only interaction they really had with dwarves was the White Witch's dwarf. But one thing I think, Warrior, you pointed out. You would have liked for them to have explained a little more about why they were drowning him. And one thing that the line which the wardrobe, I'm sorry, the Narnia films have not really captured to my satisfaction at all is the geography I mean, there's no real sense of scale on how far everything is from one thing to another.
I agree.
And even if you look at the map and you look at, for instance, where they put the Stone Bridge and where they put Aslan Sable, they're looking across about half of Narnia at that point. And the puzzle is thinking, oh, what a tiny little area you can
walk it has so many together. People.
It all fits in the wardrobe.
It was a little confusing, I have to admit.
So here, I'm sure there's probably some people saying, okay, I guess Miraz's castle is right up the...
Just down the river.
Here. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it would have been nice to emphasize that this is a place where the Telmarines never go, and they kind of hinted at it during the credits when you know, some of them wouldn't follow Glazel into the forest, but I would have liked to have seen more of that.
I have to say, I was wondering how they would handle the fencing scene between Edmund and Trumpkin.
I wish that had just been about, I really think, literally 4 seconds longer. It just needed one extra beat there. But other than that, I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, it was over pretty quickly, but still, the way they did it, I thought, yeah, this is actually pretty well done, considering the height difference and how they're gonna do it. And Trumpkin at all did not look like a fool, which I wanted him to come across as a really dangerous fighter.
Yeah, I expect that is something they were concerned about, and I think that's the reason that Trumpkin he pretends to drop the sword when Peter hands it to him, and then he comes out of nowhere and he realizes he was just kind of fooling them. And he gets a few knocks in on Edmund at the beginning because they didn't want people to think that, well, he's a dwarf, he's so much shorter. They didn't want people to think that Edmund had a big advantage. And so I think that was the reason they did that. And it's like, well, you beat a dwarf, big deal. You know, they didn't want people to think that.
Yeah. I liked how they had that move from the book, you know, where he slashes under his legs.
Yeah.
That's
just
what I always remembered from the book, and I was like, oh, they put it in there.
Yeah, I agree. Such a memorable, I think this is one of the most exciting sword fights in the books. Lewis has such a memorable description of it. And I think it was the sound design in this one that really did it. It gets louder and louder and louder, knocks it away. And it really got, you know, it accomplished what it needed to accomplish, which was, you know.
It was more intense, yeah.
Yeah, it shows, you know, Trumpkin's like, whoa, these guys, there really is more than meets the eye here. And there's kids are a force to be reckoned with. And so I think it really, even though I would have liked it to be just a tad bit longer, I think it essentially did what the book does.
And I mean, as far as this the sword choreography standpoint, it was pretty well done. They didn't really do much what we call cheating, which is, you know, if you compare the three Pirates of the Caribbean films, you know, Bob Anderson, who did Princess Bride, Empire Strikes Back, and Lord of the Rings, he did the first one. And that one has really amazing sword fights, but if you watch the second and third ones, then they'll maybe start a swing in one shot, and then they'll cut to another shot where they hit, which is what we call cheating, where they're not really doing the whole fight, they're just kind of chopping around to give you the illusion that they're fighting, and this didn't really have that, which I was happy to see.
Yeah, I agree.
But we don't have Susan's archery contest.
Who wants to go?
Gym fan or warrior?
Okay. Are we talking about the same scene or?
Oh, I was actually. I just mentioned that they don't have Susan in the archery contest. There.
Yeah, that was a bit.
I wanted that, but it was. I guess it would have slowed things down too much. And she got to use the arrow different places.
No.
So.
Yeah, I think that's the reason they cut it. It's like, okay, let's move on with the story here. You know, he knows that they're cool and all that. But I think that, you know, you look at this shot in one of the first behind-the-scenes videos that was so controversial with Susan and Caspian on the crossbow. I bet you that's the archery.
Yeah.
I bet you that's the shooting match right there between Caspian and Susan. And on an extended edition, we'll probably see it if they make one.
Yes.
I probably will. Mm-hmm. They like their money.
Yeah.
I may not buy the extended edition, actually.
Put that opening video game scenes back in, you know, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Although I have to say, in my personal opinion, the C.S. Lewis documentary in the extended edition made it worth the buy.
Oh,
it was really good.
The extras were really good.
I like that.
But back to scene are we on?
Yeah, no back clue.
I think we basically just finish with Whathorn, and then we go cut to Caspian.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Right. His flowery shirt.
Yes. And that set, that's one of those sets, and there are many of them. But that is one of the sets that sticks out in my mind as being exactly how I imagined it in the book.
That's one of those scenes that I realize the film is so quickly paced, and to lengthen any one scene would start to kind of bog it down. But that's one of those scenes also I kind of wished in my mind, I wish we could have, I mean, part of the reason it's shorter is that, you know, Trumpkin's not there, so it doesn't need as much time, but I'd like to hang out here for a little bit, you know?
Kind of like
I wasn't so sure about some of the Silmarine fashions, but they had weird kilt combination with some, like, woman's pinafore sort of thing, or, you know, it looked weird, like, it had a, like, female fashion with kilt and all this sort of thing, do you know what I mean? But when the Silmarines are wearing their evening wear or whatever, like with their in their bad
fancy clothes.
Yeah.
It was very. Some of it was very, very odd. It was,
I didn't like Caspian's outfit at the end, but that's for another time.
Eyes. I have one friend who will. He is not a person of, shall we say, discretion. And we were watching the movie, and he said what everyone was thinking. He just said out loud, and I'm sure almost everyone heard, "Oh, I thought he was wearing a dress for a second there."
It was quite enough.
I saw that. I had to do a double take. I was like, what is he wearing?
Puff sleeves and the...
Tullmarine label.
Okay, back to... Hunter and everyone.
Back to what Rillian said, I didn't really get the sense that the scene was, you know, you're saying you thought it was too rushed and you wish it had been a little longer. I didn't really get that sense. I thought it was just the right length.
I didn't think it was too rushed. I just felt it could have been a little more development. Like, you know, so much of it is, I just forgot the word. It's a term in rhetoric.
As you're thinking, let me just point out, this is the only spot in the film where Trumpkin is named. Truffle Hunter says Trumpkin knew what he was doing. That's the only part of the film where Trumpkin is actually
really?
Named. If not for that, you would not. If not for that, you would not even know what Trumpkin's name was. I'm pretty sure.
Some films do that. I know if you watch the Fellowship of the Ring.
I'm pretty sure. Can you think of another place where they say Trumpkin? I mean, the first few times I saw it, I thought he wasn't named at all. And then just last night when I saw it, I caught that Truffle Hunter says that Trumpkin knew what he was doing.
Well, I think Boromir's only... I know the first time that Boromir is named in Fellowship of the Ring is the part on the mountain where he picks up the ring. That's the first time his name even comes up.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was just... there's so many little moments in the film where they kind of expect the audience to fill everything in. Like when Susan says, "What horn?" Well, and then it cuts. You know, well, obviously Trumpkin fills them in. And then you have the part, "Do you realize what this is?" You know, Truffle Hunter asks, you know, he said, "Oh, well, us."
I thought that was a very nice cut that it says cuts from Whathorn to Caspian, who's.
Yeah, I thought that worked really well.
Oh, but this is the first time we've seen Caspian in a while since the opening scene. That hit me at the first viewing that, gosh, we haven't seen this guy in, like, what, 20 minutes in the movie's called Prince Caspian?
Yes. Too long.
And once again, just because of the way they restructured it, maybe that couldn't be helped. Mm-hmm.
I think you're pointing out something, Glumpuddle, that I've noticed a lot of reviewers have commented on how they said, you know, it's not really that much about Prince Caspian.
It really isn't, yeah.
And of course, if you know the story of Lewis's
writing, really wasn't either, though.
Well, here's the thing. Lewis wanted to call it The Return to Narnia, and he kept changing the story and finally the title, and finally ended up being Prince Caspian, but that wasn't his first
book,
choice.
Though, there's so much more of Caspian in the book, and also there's a huge 4-chapter flashback right in the center, and then after that they're trying to get to Caspian and trying to put him into the throne and anything. So Prince Caspian seems like a much more appropriate title in the book to me.
Return to Narnia, that's a really lame name to me.
it's still the subtitle. Just open up your
Prince
Caspian.
Yeah.
It's sorry. Called Prince Caspian, The Return
like, what,
to Narnia.
Like, what was Silver Chairs? It was like Lights Out Under Narnia. What was that one?
Gnomes Under Narnia.
Gnomes Under Narnia, Knights Under Narnia, News Under Narnia.
In the news,
and the silver chair.
The silver chair,
like the journal news under Narnia.
The silver chair under Narnia. Maybe they could have done. But,
the silver chair
works.
As long as, yeah, confuse it
silver
with the
chair. Silver chair is an interesting title.
But
anyway,
which book are we on anyway?
Well, we're finishing up this scene. I don't
know. This
got
is
the
first time we hear Truffle Hunter, and I love Ken Stott as Truffle Hunter.
I thought it was okay.
I thought he was fantastic. It was not how I imagined him, but I just goes, look what
I
did they do? Just the way he delivered that.
I like the character. Yeah.
Everyone in the first time we all watched it, when he says, "Look what you made me do! I worked all morning on that soup." Everyone just went, "Oh."
Morning on that soup. Yeah.
But I guess I liked him. I just wish he'd been in the story more.
Yeah. Right. Although he's
not
really in it in the book that much either.
Yeah,
Well, he's not at all in the scene later with the witch coming back. But anyway, that's
yeah.
Jim Fan, you were saying something?
No, it didn't relate to the scene. But I know after we saw the movie at the El Capitan, a few people were commenting how that did not sound like Ken saw at all. I've never heard him, so I wouldn't know, but. They said, it didn't sound like him at all.
What doesn't sound like? Oh, go Ken Stott, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard that before the movie came out, too. It's kind of weird, but you know, maybe they did something in post-production, or maybe he's just
that good.
That's
what I thought as well, because his name was in the credits, wasn't it?
Yeah,
maybe I can, you know, what I could do here, I could just change all your voices to change the octaves lower, you know, Jim Fans and Razors.
Oh, dear. Darth Vader's here.
where are we? Oh, there's another moment in the scene where, you know, Caspian grabs his armor and he's about to walk out the door. And when they showed that in some behind the scenes clips before the movie came out, I thought that it was supposed to, I figured it was supposed to mirror the scene in Wardrobe where the Pevensies are about to leave. And I was thinking they were going to tell Caspian, oh, you've got to save us. You've got to save Narnia. You go, no, I can't do it. I'm not ready. You know, oh, it's so cheesy. And I'm glad that's not what it was, that he was just leaving because, you know, I suppose he was still wanting to run away because he figured Miraz would be looking for him. But I'm glad they didn't do the whole reluctant hero thing with Caspian again.
Yeah, that would have been a bit
old.
Yeah.
Caspian really does jump to the occasion.
They actually are, you know, in the couple scenes later, we'll get to that, you know, later, but they're actually pulling him back, where he's wanting to go and just explain everything, and they're like, hey, wait a second here, you know, they might not be as understanding, you know, so he was was not the reluctant hero.
I guess we're moving into the next scene.
Yes, the next scene, that's where Cornelius is arrested, and, you know, he walks in and sees that, you know, Miraz is, you have quite the library, doctor, you know, they have that whole thing.
That was quite good.
Thank you.
I love this scene. I thought it was great.
I love the set.
Great set.
I mean, there's everything about the Miraz Castle I just love.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, and it was really good. And I love how he just sort of slammed the arrow down on the picture of the Pevensies.
Yeah.
I thought I did a really good of kind of connecting them back, you know, to the old Narnia. That's kind of what the sense I got out of it. It had very much of the old Narnia in it. And, you know, with the arrow and the paintings and everything.
Yeah, and Susan's arrow really sticks out. Like, the rest of the color palette of the castle, Susan's
red
really jumps out as being out of place.
And by the way, I thought it was really neat how they kept, it kind of ties into the end of the movie, but how they kept the arrow.
Yeah, I didn't catch that till like
the
third viewing, actually.
Really, really good idea.
Oh,
yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Or, yeah, that's the arrow that Cepespian uses to kill Miraz. I didn't catch that till the third viewing, I don't think.
And they kept quite a few lines from the book, too, compared to the Lion Witch Wardrobe.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely.
True. I was really happy about that.
Warrior, I want to hear your views on this, and then Jim Fan, because I think Glumpen and I talked about this a little bit in the last episode. And I want to know what you think. We talked about, in this scene, we get to Miraz talking about myth of Narnia and you should learn of your history and it's blah, blah, blah. You know, what do you think? Does it seem a little ambiguous to you on what the theme is here on myth versus reality, or the history of or extinction of Narnians? You know, did it seem a little unclear to you on what the Telmarines actually believe?
It did. I would have liked it to be a bit more clearer for those who didn't know the original story, but also even if you did know the story, that it just would tie the story together a lot better, because that's really the point of the story, myth becoming reality. But knowing that the old ways are the proper ways, you know, Aslan's way, he exists. It, even if people push him and the Narnian creatures out of their minds, they still exist. And that, you know, humanism isn't the right answer, sort of thing. I thought that was could have been translated a bit better in the movie.
I can completely agree that it was never, you could interpret it, it was never made clear, do the Telmarines believe the Narnians are extinct, or do they believe that they never existed at all? In the book, it's pretty clear they believe they never existed at all. They're fairy tales. And you could, if you really want to analyze it, you could interpret it as they do believe they're fairy tales, but it needed to be clear, since you're absolutely right. That is the major theme in Prince Caspian, is the myth becoming fact.
Yeah.
Because you have, you know, Miraz seems to be the one who is the first to accept that they're real, and maybe that they were real in the past. And of course, it's only the council around them that said, "Oh, those old wives' tales." Or,
agree.
What do you think, Jim Fan? Because we didn't have you with us last episode. Sorry.
Yeah.
my mistake.
Inside. Yeah, it was Rillian's mistake. I must agree.
That was the
loyal woman that she has waited the whole time during the last episode online, and somehow we missed her. I should have sent off an email, but all that is in the past.
And to make up for that, we're going to let Jim Fan do all the talking for the rest of the episode.
Woo!
See ya. Bye.
Not really. But anyway.
No comment.
Okay.
I didn't have a problem with anything. I never really thought of that long and hard. I thought they did a really good job, you know, showing how the Telmarines, you know, reaction to Narnia as it is slowly coming back. That was done really well. Like, I never really thought of it. I never crossed my mind that there was any issue with it.
It is important, though, because that idea, just if you're C.S. Lewis fan, it's like, you know, it's not the extinct being, it's not the extinct becoming discovered as unextinct. It's something that was thought as, oh, fairy tales, you know, that's all myth, blah, blah, is actually real. And you get to see the heart of the book, I think, is Caspian's joy over discovering that all these stories I've heard, they actually are real. Here they are. They're in front of me, and I can touch them. It's real.
We can all go see Journey to the Center of the Earth for that.
What's that?
Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hasn't that already been made in the 50s?
That looks like such a horrible movie. Actually, you know, we could have done, if we really wanted to have fun today, we could have done our whole analysis on the VH1 commercial.
Oh, yeah, let's do that. Let's save that for next time. So many theological implications in that video, you know. I don't think we could fit it all into one episode.
My brain can only handle so much pain.
Is that the one with the two crazy women and
Caspian? Yes.
That was disturbing.
It was different.
But that's not
Ben
a movie.
Barnes made them look like complete idiots. He actually didn't look like a fool so much there. He actually looked like, I'm a tired man who's getting paid a lot of money to do this, and I'm donating it to charity, and that's why I'm going through with it.
Yeah, our next episode can be a whole in-depth analysis of that video. But the movie...
Anyway. Real quick, what's the next scene? I don't know if we have time.
I just want to say that I do like this Cornelius being arrested, because I think it mirrors what happens to Nurse in the book. And it's important to show that these days in Narnia, you can be killed or sent away for, you know, believing in this stuff. And I really like this scene for that reason. But the next scene,
Cornelius in the movie a bit more, I'll tell you.
Yeah. But the next scene is Glasswater when they're in the boat.
Yeah.
Do we want to do that scene real quick?
I can have another 15 minutes, yeah.
Okay. That's because that has the bear, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That includes the bear.
All right, let's do that scene, then we'll wrap it up for this one.
All right.
They row the boat, they row the boat, they row the boat. Then they stop.
Well,
hey,
can't just skip over that, because one of my favorite lines when, you know, Lucy is looking up at the trees and says, they're so still. And then, you know, Trumpkin says, the trees, what do you expect? And then Susan says, you know, oh, they used to dance. And Trumpkin's kind of like, uh-huh. But I thought that was such a great moment, introducing, setting up the sadness of, oh, the trees, they used to be alive. And then, of course, that really pays off at the end when they come save the day at the battle.
This would have been a great place to put in a line about the River God.
Yeah, I agree. There was no setup for the River God at all. He just kind of shows up. And here when Trumpkin's talking about, you know, the trees, no one's heard from them since and all that. And then it would have been a great place to throw in, and the River God, you know, no one's heard about any of them. Although,
see, the thing is, the bridge was so recent. There, you know, they originally in the book it was, you know, break my bonds or because of the bridge or something. I'm trying to remember.
Well, there's an echo effect right when you're saying that, Jim Fan. I'm hearing some kind of echo effect when you're doing the break my bonds.
Oh my goodness.
It came in right when you said that.
Break my bonds.
Break my bonds, bonds, bonds.
I think it's interesting here that it's not. Here's another thing that's kind of unclear. It's not completely clear exactly what Trumpkin believes. It seems here that, you know, like us then, but he abandoned us after you lot did. It just kind of, it seems like he is saying that he does believe in them, but doesn't believe that Aslan can help them or doesn't believe he's going to. But then there's a line later where he says, you know, I'm not going to jump off a cliff for someone who doesn't exist. And so it's not completely clear exactly what Trumpkin believes. And in the book, of course, he's a skeptic until almost the very end.
He doesn't believe in anything.
Right.
How come Andrew didn't hire us to do the analysis of the script before the movie was made?
Send out final approval.
Probably thought we'd have asked for money.
Oh, please.
Delete the scene, delete the scene, delete the scene.
Break the whole thing, start over.
Okay. Well,
and then the
okay,
bear
I'm
scene.
Sorry. I didn't mean to skip over your favorite line.
Right, but it's the bear scene, yeah.
Can you forgive me?
Okay, bear scene, yeah.
Actually, I like the bear scene a lot.
Love it. They get they spent more time on it than the book does, and they really used it
to inject
show
a bit of action. That's why.
Yeah, well, I
it's
think
a character
it's
moment.
They wanted to emphasize the book. It's not so much about this. I mean, they chose to take the scene and use it to show how different Narnia is and how shocking it is for the kids, like Lucy. And I thought that she kind of looked like it would have been better if maybe we'd seen the bulgy bear do a cameo before this. That way you could understand why Lucy's like, hello there, you know, and walking up to them going, you idiot, you idiot, run away, you know. But they really used it to show, you know, and even Susan hesitates to shoot and, you know, suit and Peter, you know, that I don't think he could talk at all. It just shows. And then Trumpkin, of course, has the line we all know, you may find Narnia, we'll sub its place, and you remember. And,
oh my goodness,
I think
that's three times before.
What's that? Yeah.
That line
so I think
from the trailer.
Yeah, so I think I love the scene for that reason. I think they kind of took a little thing from the book and expanded on it in a way that seemed very much in the spirit of it. And I think this is a great scene.
I think one reason I liked the scene so much is because I was fully convinced that Susan shot the bear.
Yeah,
I was surprised as everyone.
Companion seemed to lead you to the idea, and it was Trumpkin. Thank God.
Yes, it was Trumpkin. So Susan the Gentle still applies there.
For one scene, there's Susan the Gentle, sort of.
Well, also
like Susan the Hesitant.
Right.
Well, especially
it is the same reason as in the book, though, that she wasn't sure if it was a talking bear or not.
So everyone cheers, yay!
She might have still, you know, done it in the book, even at that moment, if she knew it was a ferocious bear and not a wild bear. But part of the thing is, I thought, looking back, if Susan had shot the bear here, she'd have looked like a trigger-happy lunatic. I mean, really, she'd have looked like, oh, bear!
Right.
You know?
Right.
But I was surprised as everyone else, because everyone expects Susan to shoot the bear.
Yeah.
And then you see Trumpkin with his bow.
And then the way they do it, where they kind of cut away in the back.
Whoa. Peace.
Freedom. Come on.
Justice. Revolution. Jim Fan, you go first.
No, I was just commenting how Trumpkin, during that scene, he's kind of getting a little frustrated with him. He's like, come on, get to the bear. Stop, don't go near. And like, no one's listening to me.
Pretty good CG bear, too, I thought.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was good.
Better than the bulgy bear.
Well, I don't know about that. I love the bulgy bear.
Not the CGI of...
Have we ever seen the bulgy bear?
No, the bulgy bear's good, but the CGI of him wasn't quite as good. Some of the lighting or something.
It was a lot better than Patatwig, for sure.
Yes. I agree with that
Did
one.
Did his mouth even move?
Did he have a mouth?
At the very...
Shut
the very
up!
At the very end of this scene, I think, once again, it's an example of taking something small from the book and kind of really using it to communicate something powerful, which is when Trumpkin pulls out the knife and is about to, you know, cut up some bear meat.
Yeah,
and that's just kind of a practical thing I think Lewis kind of just threw in there. But in the movie, they really use it to show what Trumpkin is talking about, that Narnia isn't the magical wonderland that the Pevensies remember it as being.
Well, especially since...
Yeah.
I mean, in comparison to the first movie, just looking at the tone of the first movie, and you just wouldn't ever imagine someone pulling out a knife. Okay, let's cut up some bear meat.
Right.
Take a dead bear. Start
cutting
up.
Oh, we just killed a minotaur. Let's cut up some meat here.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the sort of...
Welcome
back to Narnia. Let's
like,
have
this
some bear
one, like,
meat.
A lot of Prince Caspian, this is a good example of that, it is, I mean this in a good way, it's painfully realistic compared to Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There's this brutal reality to it. It's not so idealized like Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Oh, meat. Yummo.
Interesting to know that he cuts up the bear and you never see it again.
Right. Well, it's in his pockets the whole time. He kind of
they
forgot
were hungry. Okay.
They ate the whole thing.
They ate it on the way.
Peter puts the head.
All we needed is to see them all wearing different parts of the skeleton. Lucy with
it's
the bear
skull. It's like the moment in the Care Per Mel ruins where you see Lucy bite an apple. They could have had Lucy walk past and just takes a casual bite of bear meat, you know, to kind of explain.
I don't think you're going to be okay.
That's
eating
get another bottle.
To any vegetarians listening to this, we apologize.
Get another plot hole.
Has anyone had bear meat? It's actually pretty good.
No,
My uncle lives in the mountains in Colorado, and he saw a bear in his backyard, and he was in the hot tub, so he called his daughter, and she gave him the gun with the scope, and he shot the bear from his hot tub.
We don't exactly have bears in Australia, though.
We said that's the most pathetic thing you've ever done. Just, you know, how unmanly to kill a bear from the hot tub. But it was very good meat. It was very good.
Okay.
Okay. I think we're about done.
And we'll begin the next episode with what I think is a real stand up and clap moment for Narnia fans.
Reepy Cheep.
Woo!
Yeah.
We were all talking about that in my fencing class. Just go, I love Reepy Cheep. You go, wow! You
know. Who said that?
I love his theme music. I'm so sad it's not on the soundtrack.
But that's
I know,
the
it's
next
the,
episode.
His musical score is his little theme is that. Yeah. Okay. All right. Everyone, this has been a blast. Jim Fan, Glump Puddle, and Warrior for Jesus, thank you very much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
Right. Thanks for having us.
Choose all your right. last words carefully, everyone.
What'd you say?
Told everyone to choose their last words carefully.
Oh, okay.
Since we're leaving. Never mind. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
See you, everyone.
Thank you all for joining us. If you want to email me with questions about the podcast, you can email me at my email address, rillian@narniweb.com. And one more thing. Now that I think back on it, I actually think it was an elk, not a bear, that we had. Still tasty. Anyway, thank you all for joining us, and until next time, I'm your host, Rillian.